You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking. I'm your host, Nick Naughton, a printmaker with 20 years of experience bringing you news, interviews with contemporary artists, and timely stories from around the print world. The Printcast is an inky finger on the pulse of what's happening in print today, and thank you for joining me. Hello, listeners. It's been a while. I'm glad to come back to you today with the final episode of my second season of the show. Today on the show, I've got Bill Fick, an artist and general kind of figurehead of the print world. He's one of the people in the Speedball posse, so you may have seen him out and about with Carlos Hernandez. And frankly, Bill is just like a really good statesman of the print world. He's a really good representative for what's going on in print today, how you can be active, how you can be a great educator, how you can kind of do everything and still make really cool art at the same time. And I'm really excited to share with you this interview because Bill's been someone I've looked up to for a long time, and it's going to be great to share with you kind of what he does. It has been a trying time for me, I'll be honest. I've been going through a lot of interesting stuff in my personal life, you know, for sure. And then most recently, if you've seen my Instagram, my art studio burned down. You know, it's one of those disasters that you maybe read about once in a while and you don't know if it'll ever happen to you. You kind of can't picture it happening to you, but it happened to me. In downtown Los Angeles, my studio, where I shared space with 20 other artists at this place called the Little Tokyo Arts Complex, it started fire like 3 weeks ago and basically burned to the ground. And in that studio was everything of my art life, all the art I've ever collected and traded for with artists I've known throughout my entire life. And we're talking like a pretty sizable collection of prints in that regard just alone. And every print, every multiple I've made in my whole art career is gone. All of my wood carvings, my migrant worker series. I did a whole series of drawings and works about Francisco Goya and the disasters of war relating to the Iraq War. Lots of new work, all the new woodcuts I've been working on in the past year, just everything is gone. My whole archive of what I printed at my little print shop, La Cucaracha Press in Kansas City, gone. Literally everything. Keepsakes, personal items, things I collected while traveling through India where I bought like really cool woodblock stamps, gone. Every woodcut chisel, etching needle, brayer, easel, you know, blocks of wood, sharpening stones. All of it was sadly taken from my life. And I have to say that going through this experience, you know, and I know I want to get to the episode, honestly, but I did want to share that the interesting thing is that after going through such a tragedy and such loss, I feel oddly so grateful in that it brought me more connection to the people in my life and the people from my past than I've felt in a long, long, long time. You know, through pandemic, I think a lot of us like reconnected with people who we haven't talked to in a long time, to old friends. But this was nothing like that. This was something where I started a GoFundMe. And then as I talked about what I was going through and people started hearing about it through the different networks of sharing that were going on, I literally heard from everyone I've ever known, like almost every single person I've ever known reached out and, you know, said they were sorry to hear what happened, said, you know, can I offer something to help? They offered camaraderie because maybe they lost, you know, their work in Hurricane Katrina or some other disaster or in a, you know, in a wildfire here in California. It was really quite amazing. And I have to say, I'm so grateful for all of the love and support I've gotten from everyone. My GoFundMe has raised about $11,000 actually to help like me rebuild and like rebuy tools, find a new studio and rent that and all of it. It's really been overwhelming and I am so, so profoundly grateful for any of you and all of you who've supported me through this and who've sent nice words and even just shared it on their profile. It's meant the world to me and it's really been transformative in my life. And I don't think, aside from just losing everything, like, I don't think I'll be the same person moving forward. I did want to say, you know, I still have my GoFundMe going. The Little Tokyo Art Complex called LTAC also has a GoFundMe for the entire group of artists that's still ongoing for another month or so. And upcoming for me, I'll be doing a t-shirt publication with some artists I know here who've offered to help share and do what they can to help me raise funds. And so we're going to put out a t-shirt that's been inspired by this disaster. And I've also got a couple other shirts in the works related to the Printcast. I'm finally making merch, people. So keep your eyes peeled on my Instagram soon enough here. I have a sample. It looks cool. So I'm going to be posting about that and sharing. And then we'll be putting out Printcast t-shirts, which are going to look sick. And this other artwork I made is also going to be made into a shirt. So kind of moving into a new phase of making things to sell, because I think I've had plenty of support and donations come in. If you feel like you still want to donate, please look me up. I think it's called, it's on GoFundMe. It's Help Nick Rebuild from the Fire. You can find me on there and kind of read about the disaster, see a little bit of the art that I lost and hear my story. But anyway, I just wanted to start off today and say thank you to everybody and say that it's good to be back. And I'm excited to share with you this interview with Bill Fick, because Bill is a great guy, and this will be one I think you'll enjoy. So thanks everybody for tuning in, and on with the show.
Like, you know, a lot of times people see some of my work and they'll be like, "Oh, you must be, you know, are you disturbed? Are you, you know, have you say issues and stuff like that?" I'm like, "No, I mean, I'm just exploring things through my work, you know." I get that response a lot, you know. And I think artists who deal with, you know, with difficult work or work that you know, you're going to get that, you know. And I think some artists are actually embrace that and are like that, you know, maybe but then I think a lot of artists aren't, you know, they just were exploring things, you know.
You're listening to the Printcast Season 2 for sophisticated arty types.
Close your eyes and picture a face, a cartoonish one, black and white and kind of bulbous and deformed. You try to avert your gaze, but despite the repulsion you might be feeling, you're also feeling excited. Your eyes travel all over the contours of the crusty eyelids, across what looks like a grease-smeared nose, and you follow down one cheek along what must be the longest strand of pus or ooze you've ever seen. No, you're not seeing me without makeup. I'm actually describing a print by the artist Bill Fick. Bill Fick is a statesman for the print world, an ambassador, if you will. He teaches and travels and brings his passion and joy for printmaking everywhere he goes. His work rides the line between humorous and topical, confronting socio-political issues through the lens of his signature lowbrow linocut style. If you've had the pleasure, you might have met Bill along with his buddy Carlos Hernandez as part of the Speedball Posse Tour, which brings demos and free sample materials to studios across the U.S., including his namesake, Bill Fick's Super Graphic Black Ink, a water-miscible relief ink that prints as easily as it cleans up. Bill also co-authored a popular book with Beth Grabowski called Printmaking: A Complete Guide to Materials and Process, which might be on your studio shelf as you listen to this. Bill Fick has shown his work nationally and internationally and has work in the collection of the Fogg Art Museum, Harvard University, and the New York Public Library, to name a few. He's currently a lecturing fellow at Duke University in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Join me today as we delve into the super graphic world of this artist, Bill Fick. Bill, welcome to the Printcast.
Thanks, Nick. Excited to be here.
Great to talk to you again. I'm really fascinated with your beginning years of your life, because you were born in Indonesia, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know you were born there and then shortly after, like, moved to Venezuela, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. My dad worked for an oil company. So I was born in 1963, and my parents had been living out there in Indonesia, in Sumatra, which was Western Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And they'd been there since the mid 50s. So, I mean, this is like different planet, you know, I mean, it was the 50s. They were basically in the jungle. And, my mother is from, you know, from Florida, had never left the country. It was totally like, you know, like, wow, what the heck is going on, sort of thing. My dad was always someone who wanted to travel. But anyway, so they were there since the mid-50s, and then I was born, and then we moved to Venezuela shortly after that. So then we moved to eastern Venezuela, which is, Venezuela has two oil areas, like the eastern side and the western side, and we lived in the eastern side for a while, basically when I was still a baby, very young, and then we moved to western Venezuela when I was older, and that's basically where I grew up, you know, until I was about 14.
Did you go to like American consulate schools and stuff like
that?
Yeah,
it was an American school. The company that my dad worked for, there was an American school. I mean, it's really weird. I mean, this is sort of a just bizarro. Well, not bizarro, but this was typical that we went to school, but we had, the Venezuelans had their side of the school and we had the Americans had our side of the school, and our parents all worked in the same place, but there was this separation. And I think it was because in the beginning, what it was sort of like that we had a way of teaching and the Americans had a certain way of teaching and the Venezuelans had a certain way of teaching, and which seems really weird. Like why in the world can you just not all, you know, work, you know, be in school together? But mm-hmm. we were in school together. We had assembly in the morning together. And then we went to our separate sides of the school. It's really weird.
It is weird. Yeah.
We did. And then the Americans, and it was definitely, you know, we were the Americans. So we did socialize with the Venezuelans, and our parents were friends and all that kind of stuff. And we all hung out, but we tended to, it was still very much like an American thing, you know, like we were, you know, we had the camp that we lived in was sort of the management camp. And so all the management people lived there. And then we had this thing called the labor camp, which is where the laborers work or they live. And that was all Venezuelans. So it was definitely this class thing, this, you know, national, you know, between countries and sort of thing. But anyway, it was just, you know, thinking back on it, it just really not, you know, something that we talk about now is like how, you know, as Americans, we came in and, came into these countries and, you know, had our companies in these places, and we, were able to extract a lot of their resources and stuff like that. At the time, you know, you wouldn't have thought about it, but now you're looking back on it, it's like, that's weird. But then actually before we left, the Venezuelans nationalized their oil. So they actually, then they became where there was their, you know, they were in charge as opposed to the American companies. So,
okay. Yeah.
But that was, you know, that was the way it was back in those days. And it was, you know, just, multinational corporations that, you know, kind of went all over the world and did their thing, you know, anyhow,
it's like that colonizing story of our country.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it was interesting because we, you know, we all spoke Spanish. We hung out, you know, we went all over it wasn't like we didn't learn to speak Spanish. We all were integrated that way. But we definitely kept our sort of our American thing going on, you know. It was, it was definitely, we weren't, but there were some Americans who work for service companies and were not like, we were with part of the really one of the big companies that was basically was Exxon. But there were companies that served, like were really called service companies, and a lot of those folks got a little bit more, they would live in communities that were much more integrated with the Venezuelans and much more like not a part of what we were like. It was like a military camp where we lived. I mean, it was like our, you know, we all had our own thing. We had a commissary. So it was very, you know, separated. Although, like I say, there was a lot of the management people were Venezuelans, and our parents all were all together, and all the kids hung out.
Yeah.
It was definitely a socioeconomic thing where there was a separation between the classes and stuff like that.
Hmm. Well, then, so after what, around 14 or something, you ended up coming back to the States and going to boarding school, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what happened? So in 1976, the Venezuelans they nationalized the oil industry. So that changed the whole sort of structure of the company and the dynamics. So the school that we went to, that closed, and it was the school I went to was up to eighth grade. So I had to go somewhere, but generally what Americans would do would either go back to, would come to the States and go to school, maybe where some family are, or I ended up going to a boarding school, which a lot of people did, was go to boarding schools. Cause there really weren't, you know, English speaking American schools beyond like eighth grade. There was one, but it wasn't that great. So a lot of people just ended up going overseas, but going back to the States or going to boarding school wherever. And so I went to boarding school in Massachusetts. I went to two different schools up there. I actually went away to boarding school when I was 13. You know, so that was 7th, 8th, and 9th, and then at one school, and then I went to another school from 10, 11, 12.
It wasn't until later you got into art, right? Like more college years, but even then it took a little while for it to take.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was really into sports, so took up a lot of my time.
Oh yeah,
I never got real good at it to where it was like, oh yeah, you're going to go work, you know, play in college and all that. But
were you football or wrestling or what'd you do?
No, soccer, basketball, and baseball.
Okay, yeah.
So, And it ended up being focused more on basketball and soccer. But yeah, so that, you know, when I was in high school, that was kind of one of my big things. And then I took some art classes, but I wasn't really into it. I mean, I wasn't like, this is what I want to do kind of thing. And then I graduated, went to Duke as an undergrad. Here I'm back at Duke. But anyway, at this time I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I thought, you know, at that age, you're thinking like, what am I going to do that sort of have a responsible job or something? And I thought, oh, what about like computer graphics or something like that? But this is the mid 80s, and computer graphics required serious, you know, skill with like programming, and it was way different. I'm sure Photoshop was developed by then, but it was nothing like it is now. So
it was so hard to learn back in the day. Yeah.
I was taking some computer science classes and realized I was terrible at it. So I ended up sticking with the graphics side, which was art. So I ended up I majored in art. And I was like maybe one of two or three people, because Duke's not known for its arts. At the time, it was not known at all for its arts, or, you know, it's gotten much better. But anyway, at that time it was, you know, very small, very small. So I studied art there. And then when I was getting ready to graduate, I was like, well, now what am I going to do? And I had family in High Point, North Carolina, which is a big furniture place. And I thought, well, maybe furniture design could be something I could do. So, and I had met some people in the furniture design industry, you know, in furniture designers, and, yeah, it seemed pretty cool. But I didn't know anything about it. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I'll just, and so I ended up going to a college in Grand Rapids, Michigan after I graduated, called Kendall. Well, at the time it was called Kendall College of Art and Design. I think it's called something different now, but they had a pretty good furniture design program, and I started that. I just hated it because it was very technical and I just didn't groove on it. And so I left there after a year and went back to North Carolina, where I had sort of set up base, because my parents were still living overseas. By this time they'd moved to Saudi Arabia, and I had actually spent a little time out there, but anyway, so I was back in North Carolina, I took a year off, and then I ended up going to UNC Greensboro, after that year I took off and started my MFA at UNC Greensboro.
And so what was it that clicked along the way that like made you want to go for your MFA, like focus on art, like on that level? Made you get into print? Were you were into print when you showed up there?
Well, so the thing that kind of took that, it's one of those things that I think all printmakers experience. It was my uncle had some old linocut tools. He used to make holiday cards, and he was an artistic guy. He worked for an ad agency or related to the ad industry business. But anyway, he would do holiday cards, you know, back in the 60s and all that stuff. And so he had these tools laying around, and I had been taking art class, and I took a print class in undergrad, and I liked it. And I don't know, I must've been talking to him or something like that. And he said, well, here, you can have these tools. And so I started messing around with it. I just totally, and I had done some relief prints. So I was already kind of into it. I knew about it. And so I was messing around with that. And this year that I was, you know, the year that I took off after the furniture design school. And then I got into it enough to where I was like, this is interesting. And so I ended up going to Penland School, and that's where Hugh Merrill was the guy that was teaching the class that I took.
Get out of here. Yeah.
AI, right? So Hugh, really, I got really jazzed. I got to say, he did a great job of getting me stoked up about printmaking.
Yeah, he's another, like,
he does a really good job of that. I don't know how many people he's influenced over the years. It's like, golly. But anyway, so that just kept pushing me further. And so when I already knew I was going to go to grad school in Greensboro, which was basically the local university. And it's a good university. The program there is good. It's been around a long time. But anyway, it really just, I mean, after taking the class at Penland with Hugh, got me stoked. And then when I got into grad school, I basically was sort of self-taught, because the printmaker there is a really outstanding printmaker. He's predominantly, he's retired now, but he was a lithographer he had been one of the early Tamron printers back when it was, I think, in LA actually. And I think he, if I got the story right, his name is John Maggio. And I think he had been June Wayne's printer. I mean, this was early because he ended up moving to Greensboro back, like, in, I think, shortly after they got started, then maybe when Tamron moved out to New Mexico. But I think, you know, he had come east. But anyway, John Maggio was an amazing printmaker, but he went on sabbatical. I think my first year he was gone. And then after that, I had already sort of gotten into my own thing with relief print. And I actually never did lithography with him, which was kind of a mistake, but I was really grooving on my relief print work. So anyway, yeah. So going to grad school there, is where I really got hooked and really, really got kind of possessed by it. And it wasn't like there really weren't a lot of people. I mean, there were some people messing around with printmaking in that program, but I was pretty much the main person. I had some other friends painters who would do prints and etchings and things like that, but no one was really just focusing that much on printmaking. So it was sort of like I was on my own, not in a bad way. I mean, I had a really good experience there. But and then the other thing that was really huge about that was there was a guy, one of the teachers there, his name was Walter Barker. He had been Max Beckman's studio assistant at Wash U when Beckman came to the States after the war.
Uh-huh.
And so he had all these stories about Max Beckman. And I mean, I became a huge Max Beckman fan.
Oh, he's one of my favorites. Yeah. The paintings and stuff he did and his prints, everything are some of my favorites for sure.
I mean, just amazing stuff. And so I'm hugely influenced by that. I mean, just in terms of German expressionist stuff, relief prints and all that whole thing. But this guy Barker, even though I took a class with him and it was about Beckman, and there was a big Max Beckman retrospective that came out about that time, and it actually came to North Carolina at the museum, and that was really huge. So I mean, so that was like one of my big influences at the time. And then also this guy Barker, he knew Gustin because Beckman had come to Wash U to replace Gustin, who had gotten a Rome prize and was in Rome. So, I mean, it was just this crazy confluence of amazing artists, you know, and just, so I, and then I was like, I loved Gustin's work too. And I still a huge Gustin fan. But that's where kind of a lot of the gnarly stuff comes from.
What do you like about Gustin? Cause I've, for some reason I've never really got it. It never clicked.
Uh-huh.
Although I think it's growing. Cause I think oddly, I feel like the imagery he made feels very contemporary right now, you know? It like took this long curve of kind of styles evolving and things. But what is it you like about Gustin's
art? I mean, what's funny, not funny, but what was interesting about it is when I first saw it, I really thought it was humorous. And there is a humor, but it's very dark, you know? And I didn't, and this was even before I read anything about him or found out anything about him, what, you know? And so as I was seeing more about the cartoony side of it and sort of how an artist of his caliber was making these really, cartoony images. And I just, you know, was totally grooving on that. And then finding out more about it and just had the satirical nature of it and the dark sort of like him going in, you know, the whole, Klan series that he did and how he was this darkness that he was exploring the evil, exploring evil and all that. I thought that was really interesting. And then also coupling that with Beckman, who had, you know, been in Nazi Germany and had dealt with the Nazis, and how that, you know, that whole history. I was very interested in German expressionism and sort of this idea of it being, you know, a much more, sort of, technically, I mean, obviously technically amazing stuff, but, you know, drawing upon more folk art, things that are like, so, you know, the German expressionists were looking at early printmaking, early woodcut, stuff like that. And then, you know, Gustin was riffing totally on comics. You know, I think he had wanted to be a comics artist when he was a kid. And so, and what's interesting about the comics thing is that it's become a huge part of my work now, but back then, so this would have been the late 80s, you know, comics were definitely, there was a separation between fine art and comics and sort of that kind of stuff. I mean,
graphic art of any kind was like separate and like even, even in school, you know, in the late 90s when I was there, you know, it was all separate. Like if you did letterpress or even screen printing, it's just like, they weren't even in the print department technically a lot of the time.
Right.
which is so bizarre to think of now, because like it's all dovetailed and merged now into this huge, like, more of a fabric of all the methods put together, you know?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely come together, but it was definitely, you know, like you say, it was definitely a separate thing back then. And a lot of, you know, the faculty I had, I had good faculty, but they definitely came from a strong, like, you know, fine art is fine art, you know?
Yeah.
So any kind of like more of this, the comics and stuff, I think they would have just been like, I don't know how to talk about that because that's nothing, that's something I do. So I really wasn't going there. I was actually drawing more upon German expressionism, early. I was really into Gothic, you know, medieval art, and mostly all the, you know, the great woodcut stuff from back in the period.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at a lot of that. And then again, you know, Beckmann was huge. And that's where I started getting to a much more like thinking about really bold black lines. Cause all his paintings are really, you know, have strong black lines.
Oh yeah.
And so that was a huge influence, but, and it, you know, in some ways his paintings are, you know, and then he would do his woodcuts and relief prints that were, you know, all very bold and graphic and had that strong line. So, yeah, that was just huge for me, you know.
So when did, like, the evolution take place where your work, I mean, honestly, the way you were describing Gustin's work, how you thought it was humorous at first, and then you kind of peel back a layer and you start seeing, like, this other stuff underneath. Like, how did your work start to gel into that same sort of vein, you know? Because I feel like your work, I look at it and my immediate take is, like, lowbrow, cartoony. It's like there's, it's funny, it's weird and gross and like awesome, and there's like cigarettes dangling out of mouths, and you know, it's all kinds of gritty and like raw. But then, you know, the titles, then I'm just like, okay, the title's like this, and then I relook at the image and I see it differently, and it, you know, it kind of unfolds in that same way, I feel.
Well, I mean, it, you know, my first woodcuts were really derivative of like a Beckmann-esque, and then I, you know, a lot of, and also very Gustin-y. But I just kept focusing more and more on sort of the character, developing these characters that, and sort of putting them in these scenes. So the stuff that I was doing shortly out of grad school was all, there were larger narratives. And again, that does harken back to more of a Beckmann, how he would create these narratives. But, so it became more, working with these individual characters, and I would develop them. So I had this one character, the hooligan, which drew upon a lot of sort of the hooliganism that was going on in at the time, you know, British football hooligans. And basically it was these out of control brutes that were going around, you know, a lot of racist stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then that evolved into working with sort of Klan characters, which, you know, that does harken to the Gustin thing. But it was, you know, I was living in North Carolina at the time that I was making those, and, you know, the history of the Klan in North Carolina. And so I was tapping into that. And then there were the, that was about the same, you know, that about the time that, you had the war in the Balkans. So there was a lot of, you know, fighting and racial stuff, you know, like, you know, the separation between the different ethnic groups. And there was a lot of that in the news. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time I was constantly listening to the news. So a lot of that fed the work that I did.
Yeah.
And so there was that. So I had, you know, the hooligans series, that was a whole series that I explored, and then and that morphed in sort of dealing with the Klan and racism and things like that. So this was in the early 90s, and then also about the same time, and I can't remember the exact date, but then that was when the Rodney King thing happened, and that blew up, and there was all, you know, that was crazy, and there was so much going on there, and so I dealt with some of that, and then I was working with a whole series of pigs. Mm-hmm. And just sort of the idea that, because in North Carolina, there's a lot of pig farming and there was a lot of pollution from pigs. So I was doing a lot of like sort of social political stuff, dealing with different, you know, topics, sort of editorial kind of imagery.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that for a while. And, you know, after a while, it actually got pretty exhausting. The imagery got really, I was enjoying making it, but it sort of became like this heavy thing. So I started morphing it into just this idea of, these beings, or, you know, like, kind of like the idea of a monster or, a character that's sort of outside the norm, misfits. I was dealing with misfits and clowns and monsters. And then I got into zombies. And so I started tapping into more, I think, more popular culture kind of stuff. So like the zombies sort of came out. You know, there was a zombie thing going on. And it just became sort of this, sort of a comment or way for me to explore this idea of the other, you know, and yeah. You know, what does that mean? Like, you know, if it's something that we're uncomfortable with, you know, what does that mean? Why are we uncomfortable with it? Or, and so it sort of evolved into that. And then, but I was still also doing a lot of animals, which is kind of riffing on sort of comics and cartoons that deal with like the animal characters, like you would see in Disney or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of bouncing around a little bit, but just basically kind of zoomed in on this idea of these different kind of misfit characters and animals and dealing with, and it always had a sort of a grotesque overtone to it. You know, and like some people say, why the grotesque? And I think for me, it's just more, I find that more interesting, I just exploring that, you know, I've always interested in the tough guy character in the comics, you know, like the, you know, in Popeye, you know, and Brutus, you know, they're fighting each other. And like,
yeah.
You know. And not that I'm cheering that character on, but it's more like why, you know, just sort of that the character that creates the trouble and how that changes the narrative, you know? So, and it might not be bad. I mean, you know, then there's characters that I make that I don't see them as troubled, but they're misunderstood, you know? So,
yeah.
But I definitely am interested in the characters that, I mean, it's like, in some ways it's easier to deal with the bad guy than it is the good guy, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. And really like who's good or bad, it really depends on like the lens through which you're looking at these people in the first place. I mean, what did you think? I saw some, I feel like it was recent news about Gustin where they had a show that was canceled or put off or something. I read it almost was getting reinstalled or I can't remember, but it was basically because of the nature of the world and with like George Floyd and all the protests for Black Lives and everything, like they viewed his like Klan imagery as kind of like, you know, off tune for the moment, you know, it's almost like why, you know, shouldn't we have these conversations? Because the fact is like they've existed this whole time until even now, the Klan, because it's like a thing we don't talk about. It's like, you know, something you kind of, you hear about it and you kind of look the other way instead of like being an ally and confronting it, you know? And,
like, well, I've definitely been following that story for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's been a lot of podcasts about it and stuff like that, but basically it sounded like the organizers of the show just felt like because of the sensitivity of the time, these kinds of images might, you know, put people off or, you know, offend people. I think the blowback was that, it might do that. But I mean, you know, Gustin was addressing these issues. They were horrible. You know, he was, as a Jew, he was, you know, he had been the subject to this discrimination. And, you know, he was exploring this idea of who these evil people were. And, you know, there was a lot of people saying, well, you know, yeah, I mean, this creates conversation. It allows us to explore these really, you know, terrible things. We need to have these conversations, and his work addressed that. And I think, sounds like what they're going to do is they were going to postpone it, but now they're not going to postpone it as long. So I think they're going to bring it, closer to but it was supposed to open like this summer, I think, or maybe even it was sometime soon.
Yeah.
It's been a huge discussion. But I think there, you know, a lot of art, there was a huge, there were a lot of artists who wrote, to say that they were disappointed in the way that it was dealt with and handled. And, but you know, it's, for me, I've always seen Gustin as a champion of human rights and someone who always seemed to be very sensitive to these issues. So it was strange to see that, you know, like, wow, if anybody was of the art, you know, in the art world who seemed to have who was really concerned and caring about that, you know, it seemed like his work really spoke to that. But I guess some people might look at it and be just misunderstand it and say, well, why is he drawing pictures of the Klan? You know, why is he doing that? You know,
I could see that. I mean, you never know how people will take a piece of art, and people absolutely can take it in completely opposite ways. Cause I've seen that just with my own stuff, you know? And, I think it just the conversation that it can foster, it doesn't give enough credit to the art. I feel, you know, that like, I think you should trust like what people will take away and,
right.
And like it's better to look at these things and kind of think about them, because I think that's what the world needs, is like we need to just really process like the darkness that's behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, get in there and like, you know, say, you know, what, you know, look at these nasty characters, like, you know, what about them? You know, why are they this way? And, you know, and how can we not, you know, we don't need, we shouldn't avoid it. We got to like get in there and like, you know, attack it in a way, you know, and really, and, you know, and some, I think in some of the, sometimes that's what I did with my work, was I felt like it was my way of processing a lot of this stuff. It's like, you know, I'm not one of those people who will go out and, you know, actively get in the streets and do all kinds of, you know, that, which, but for me, when I was doing a lot of this work early on, this social political work, it was my way of sort of fighting back in my own brain, you know, like, how do I deal with this stuff? You know, how can I, because when I'm listening to it on the news, you get really frustrated and it's like, you know, but what can you do? Right. So for me, it was a way of attacking. So I like these characters that I came up with, or these clan characters, my way of attacking, you know, of fighting back and sort of dealing with it, you know, sort of a way of, not, you know, in a cathartic kind of way, I guess, to.
Sure. Yeah.
I think a lot of artists use their work to process things, you know, have to go through that to, you know, to maybe to deal with things that are out in the world, you know? So.
Yeah. I think, I mean, sometimes you're just compelled to react, you know, and I definitely had that when I was, especially in grad school, like there was little threads of it early on in my undergrad work for sure. But then like, as I got into grad school, like, it was right around kind of the middle part of the war on terror, you know? So it was like 2005-ish. So like we'd already been at war for like 4 years, but it was just like every day in the news, and there was like horrible battles and atrocities throughout Iraq and Afghanistan. And like, I couldn't sit still and not comment.
Right.
And I made a bunch of work that went all different directions. Some of it was like blasphemous. Mm-hmm. Some of it was like too shy, like, or, you know, but I started to kind of feel like how people's reactions would kind of guide my next decisions. And then it's like, you start to dial in on like how to talk about something without triggering all the wrong responses, you know? And so you kind you start to learn how that communication works when, you know, when you're making something and putting it in front of people and you're not there to talk about it. Sometimes it's, it's a careful dance kind of, you know?
Yeah. 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 That's the thing. And it's, you want to make the work, it goes out into the world, and then you people respond to it in different ways. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of times people see some of my work and they'll be like, oh, you must be, you know, are you disturbed? Or issues and stuff like that. I'm like, no, I mean, I'm just exploring things through my work, you know?
Yeah.
But I get that response a lot, you know? And, I think artists who deal with, you know, with difficult work or work that, you know, you're going to get that, you know? And I think some artists are actually embrace that and are like that, you know, maybe but then I think a lot of artists aren't, you know, they just were exploring things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if like your work on racism and some of that stuff, got reactions that you were surprised by, or if people misread what your messaging was or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the time I made it, so this, you know, it was a long time ago. It was, I mean, people saw that I was addressing the issues of the time, you know, I think were, you know, it wasn't confusing or anything like that. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things I had, in a response, and it was with a guy, I had a show in somewhere in South Carolina. I can't remember, but, there was a guy that came to the show and he said, hey, you know, I work at a prison and, you know, I see, you know, this is some of the, and he was responding to some of the hooligan characters, people, knives and fighting and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, he goes, yeah, I really responded to that because I'm around a lot of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's, you know, for someone who'd never been in a prison or been around prison, you know, it was interesting that someone who was in that world was responding to it. And it made some sense to them in a way that I wasn't thinking about.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how, I know it's probably much later, but how did you get involved with like the Speedball? Or actually, no, let's start with the Outlaw Printmakers, which you're a part of, this big contingent
of
I don't know, like a dozen or so artists. I feel like the people in the group kind of shift, and some are in, some are out, just naturally over time and whatnot. And
I
know it's not a hyper organized thing either, but what is the Outlaw Printmaker group, and like, how did you get involved?
I mean, it's you're right. It's a loose sort of loose group of people, loose in many ways. But really, I think it was just several artists who came together, not like out of any real strong organizational way. So that would be really Tom Hawk, Dennis McNett, me, Hancock Brothers, Sean Star Wars. These were, you know, early on, it was kind of like that group of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I met Dennis at Pratt. So Dennis I was teaching at Pratt, and Dennis came to Pratt as a grad student.
Oh, cool.
So I met him there in New York. So after being in North Carolina in 95, I moved to New York City. And then I was just adjuncting at Pratt. And Dennis came as a grad student there. And then some other artists that were like Martin Mazzora and Mike Houston, were in New York at the same time. And so they were around that. And then Tom Huck started coming to New York just to visit folks. And he met, you know, we hung out. And then Sean, who knew Dennis back in Virginia. So there was all this connection between people. And so it kind of grew organically that way. But then Tom Huck became more serious about like wanting to organize it and make it more, more cohesive. And then we actually had a show in New York, at a gallery called Big Cat Gallery, which Tom had arranged. And so that was sort of the beginning, and I can't remember what the date was on that, but the person that we all admired was this guy, Richard Mock, who was a painter, but he also did all these, editorial, pieces for the New York Times for many years, and he did these lino cuts, and they were amazing. He would whip them out like in no time. So he had like, you know, the editors at the New York Times would get a hold of him and say, you know, we need this kind of an image. So he busted out like in a day. It was amazing. And he did many, many, many of them. And I had seen them, and Huck had seen them. And then I met Richard Mock when I first moved to New York. And then Huck came to visit me, and I took him to meet Richard, and we all, you know, so after a while, it was basically, you had this sort of group of people that, who were friends of Richard Mock's, and he wasn't an outlaw printmaker, but he was kind of like the person that we all admired and looked up to, because of his making these satirical social political prints, kind of very much in the style of like a Posada. You know, it was connected to a newspaper, and it was an editorial. So it was sort of this organic thing that grew, and then Huck sort of wanted to organize it and make it more organized. And then, the Hancock brothers got involved because they had been making prints for years. And we all kind of knew about them, and Huck, you know, we all kind of connected with them. And actually Dennis became very close friends with Richard Mock. So anyway, there was this whole sort of thing that grew, and it just kind of continued to solidify, and become more of a thing. And then it got more organized, and then it got disorganized.
Yeah.
And so it's a mix, you know. Carlos Hernandez, Carlos came in, became, and that was, a little bit later. But Carlos had known, John Hancock at Texas Tech, like years ago, like in the '80s, they knew each other. So there was this, you know, this, and that's the typical thing about printmaking, is that we all know somebody who knows somebody, or if we don't know each other, it's like we say, oh yeah, yeah, well, you studied with so-and-so, and
oh, totally,
and
yeah,
connection.
The art world is very small. Like,
especially in printmaking, you know, it's super small. The minute you start talking and meeting people, So anyway, there were other people that came in. I'm sure I'm missing some folks, and I apologize if I'm missing, but it's been an on off kind of, we did have a big show in Fort Wayne a few years ago, which, Dennis McNett helped coordinate that. And that was a great show at the Fort Wayne Museum of Art. It was a really terrific show. And there were lots of other artists involved with that one. So it's, you know, I think the thing that brings us all together is that we all work in a narrative form, printmaking. And I think we're influenced by many of the same artists. And you generally pretty, you know, mostly satirical, mostly kind of in your face. But all, like, you know, all very good work, you know? I mean, everything was really, really strong.
Yeah, all those guys are excellent artists. Been following most of them for a long time. And, you know, Huck especially, I remember, I don't know if it was when I first found out about him, but it was, there was an SGC conference at Wash U where he was, I think, a teacher. And then there was all this like hullabaloo about, I actually don't know the back, like someday I'll hopefully get the backstory. We don't have to go over it, but Huck like bailed on the conference and then launched like a competing event at the same weekend became like this. This like outlaw conference event thing that was off site, and it was, I don't know. I just remember being like, man, that's some epic. Like it was so cool. And, you know,
well, I mean, yeah, I think that that's the, it has, you know, there's always been this sort of the outlaw component has always been there. But I think what, you know, a lot of it is just this idea, the sort of the camaraderie between the artists and the passion too. I mean, that's the thing, you know, if you ever meet Tom Huck, you can't meet a person more passionate than him about printmaking.
For sure.
And, you know, and we're all like super passionate about it. And I think so, you know, you get a lot of emotions going, you know, and I think, you know, that Wash U conference, there was a lot of emotion. And,
it gets that way too. Cause it's political and it moves and it's, so it's a very hard event to be running when it changes like almost completely every year and it's new people and you know.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's the thing about Outlaw for me, there's definitely a punk rock component to it. So it's like, you know, kind of in your face and, you know, I'm the old guy in the group, so I kind of, I stay on the sidelines, you know, but me and the Hank, well, the Hancocks, they're pretty, you know, they like to get in your face. That's good.
Yeah.
And Carlos and I sit by and, you know, have a little bourbon on the side, but, or I smoke a cigar or something like that. But anyway, I mean, the bottom line is that the Outlaw Printmakers is a very passionate group of people, really, you know, hardcore making prints. Not that, you know, there are a lot of folks like that, but I think the group is sort of, that's sort of like something where everybody takes pride in really working hard and making prints and super excited and passionate about the print world and getting the world and getting the word out there. I think everybody sees, you know, in that group sees themselves as, you know, kind of on a mission to, you know, for printmaking, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like that connects to Speedball in a way. I was reading on your site. I have like a can of the Super Graphic Black and I, you know, this is not a plug of any kind. I don't have any sponsorships. Although Speedball, if you're listening, we should talk again.
All right. Yeah.
But, you know, I've always been skeptical. I'm like old school. So like oil based everything. And when I, you know, I work in essentially kind of like painting studios at this point with like no facilities or anything. So it's like oil cleanup and all this stuff. But the ink really worked great, you know, and I'm hand printing everything, like hand burnishing and it.
Oh, cool.
My woodcuts were coming out like awesome. And the only thing I don't like is that after you leave it sit, it's water miscible inks kind of have to absorb through the pressure into the stock of the paper, you know?
Right. And yeah, very slow.
I love when after you print, like the ink, like oil based just like seals off on the block surface the water miscible seems to, it stays alive a little bit. So when you touch the block, even weeks later, it's like, you can still smudge off ink on your hand. And like, I don't know if I like that aspect, but otherwise it's excellent. And it cleaned up like, you know, super easy and everything was, I mean, kind of a dream, like really, really well done product.
Yeah. It's been great. I mean, it does dry slow, but I think you just kind of fit that into your work schedule.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole cleanup thing and the ease of print, it prints so easily but yeah, that was really cool because, actually that I got to say a lot of that had to do with Carlos because, Carlos had been working with Speedball, and they had been consulting him about their screen printing inks. And, they started talking to him about like that they were going to be rolling out some relief inks. And, he said, hey, well, you know, Bill Fix, he's like your neighbor. He's right there. Because Speedball's in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so we got in touch and just slowly working out, like, you know, I was working with their ink chemist, Bud, amazing, really great guy.
Yeah.
And just, you know, we kept going back and forth on like what we, you know, how was the ink working and all that. And so we came up with the Super Graphic Black and it's been great. But yeah, just working with them has been really terrific. They're just, super nice folks, really, just really genuine and really want to, you know, do the right thing for printmaking. and always asking questions. They're always open to having people ask them questions. Mm-hmm. And you know, they I mean, it's so great that, you know, that they, you know, Carlos and I mean, we're on hold right now with the whole pandemic thing, but are, you know, traveling around and, spreading the gospel, as we say, and just sharing our knowledge and stuff like that with going around to different schools and having Speedball support that has been really, really great. You know, and then the Print Posse started. That was actually another Carlos invention. Carlos is like our inventor of all these things. He's wow. Really,
I had no idea.
Yeah, he came up with the Print Posse idea. But anyway, so then that was cool because then it expanded out to other people. I mean, Carlos and I were doing the road show. And then Carlos said, came up with the idea of the posse. Well, it was, you know, he came up with the idea. Then I think they took that and ran with it and said, okay, well, there's lots of these are the artists that, you know, we want to work with. So they selected a group of artists that they really liked and had been communicating with or had seen their posts or had seen their work. And so that's been really, and then they've gone on to a third level of, which is sort of the demo artists, which is a group of artists that are all over the country and basically are doing demos or, you know, they're around. So it's like they've got this whole kind of army of artists out there working spreading the love, you know. So it's been great, you know. I've really enjoyed working with them, and they've been super, super, super supportive of everything. So
yeah, I've had some discussions with some of the people over there, and I have to say I'm just really impressed. I mean, for one, it's like if you're an educator and you've been printing for a while, it's like, you know, the utility and the necessity of Speedball as a brand in like the studio. It's everybody's using that stuff, especially when you're learning. It's like the number one material for screen printing and things, and if you're doing things at home or you need just like an easy kit to make something off, you know, on the fly, it's like they have all these great products. And like the transition to what they're doing now, you know, like I saw like on Killchoice, she's doing like, I think their takeover like this week maybe. Just the fact that they're doing that, it's just like, it's, there's something so smart that they're pointing the attention to like the community that they serve rather than at themselves, you know? And it's like, I don't see that much. I mean, you see that in some branding and marketing and stuff, but the fact that they hand over their platform to like so many guest artists, like every week almost, I think they do it now. And you're seeing their products, but you're seeing it in action. You're seeing it in the real world. It's like, you can relate to all these people. You learn about all these new artists and see their process or what they're making. It's just like level upon level of like smart business, especially in a niche market like they're in, where it's just like, it's a small kind of audience. It's like very passionate and tight, and there's, you know, people need what they're making, but it's like how to engage and I don't know, become so relatable to like their whole market base. Is just, I'm just like in awe of how it's all worked and how it keeps rolling and going on. And you know, now they have all these new inks, and so there's like a whole stockpile of cool fun colors with like fun names, and like it's just like they're just like rolling with it in all these really just awesome ways, I think.
I mean, I think they've really understood sort of that they understand the community. I think they see the community, and they're like, wow, you know, all these people, like they hang out with each other, they talk to each other, they go, you know, they'll go to these conferences, and they, you know, they're always talking about materials and products and stuff. And I think they figured that out. They're like, hey, you know, this is like this whole, instead of it just sort of like, we make a product, you know, this is what we do. They actually kind of want to get in there and hang out. You know, they're like, oh, hey, this is fun. You know, like we're going to have fun too. You know, we're not just going to like tell you what we got. We want to, you know, and it's funny because like they don't have backgrounds. The staff, they're not artists. And they, you know, in the beginning they were like asking lots and lots of questions, and they've learned a lot, obviously. And you know, they're the experts on the material, the inks and things like that. But yeah, I think they actually enjoy, you know, the community that they're helping to support. And I think, you know, they really like being a part of it. You know, I kind of see it as sort of like a skateboard company that, you know, they sponsor skateboarders.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, because, you know, they have stickers and patches. And I think, you know, they realize, you know, hey, you know, this is a really super strong community of people doing lots of different things. But in general, they all kind of like to hang out and talk And you know, and I, you know, it seems like they really enjoy it, you know, which I find really great.
Yeah. It seems really authentic. And, I think that's just really why it works, you know?
Yeah.
Well, here, let's transition. Let's get into, let's get technical.
Technical.
Woo!
All right.
So you're Lionel Bill, and we figured, we did a pre-talk about this, but I figured like the thing to do is just talk about Lino Cut, because I feel like you have a lot of knowledge, and you even just, you know, before when we talked, you mentioned a few things that I hadn't thought about or heard about that were a different approach. And I heard some things in Huck's interview with you that I also, you know, now that I look at your prints, I totally get how you're making your imagery and stuff now. It makes total sense now. But let's talk about, like, so what kind of, you use the unmounted linoleum?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that was one of the big revelations is, you know, when I first started LinoCut, I did use the mounted stuff. And makes sense because, you know, you go to the store and you see this linoleum and it's mounted and you're like, oh, I'll buy this.
And yeah, it's all flat and everything. And
yeah. It's, you know, and, but you know, like, but then you're like, why is it elevated like that? You know, like, what's the reason? And then they think, well, you know, it's like wood, you know, it's like elevated, it's thick. But anyway, so as I got into, as I was doing that, I was learning that, well, you know, when you print, it can be kind of a pain because when you go through the press, you have to engage the block. If you've got a press that where it's not, where the drive is not at the bottom, but it's like, you know, you're driving from it. So whenever you hit the block is when it engages and moves the press.
Yeah.
So
you almost need like bumpers in the front and back to like go on a thick piece.
Or, And you know, people who do relief are like, well, what's the big deal? That's always what I do. But
yeah.
But with Lino, it's like when you have the unmounted linoleum, it's so much easier to print it because when you're running it through the press, it engages and it's not like you have this big bump. You got to, you know, it's you know, fairly flat, so you just go right over it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then lots of other things, you know, it's you can get bigger sizes, way bigger sizes. When I got out of grad school, I started buying linoleum by the roll, and you know, Dick Blick sells it by 3 feet by 90 feet. I don't buy it like that anymore, but I would buy the roll because I was cranking this stuff out. So I would so I always tell people that if you're going to buy it on the roll, make sure you cut it down and then put it under weight, because if you leave it on the roll, it's just going to, it barely never ever gets flat. So
yeah.
I would do is buy the big roll and just start cutting them down to sizes, or even just cutting them down to a smaller size and then put them under weight for like 3 months. And then generally they were flat by then. And that's, it's actually a cheaper way of buying it. But I do recommend that if people are going to buy rolled linoleum, that you do cut it and press it down for a while, because if you try to cut it and then print, you know, work it right there, it's going to be stay rolled and it's just a real pain.
Yeah.
So I actually now buy all my linoleum pre-cut. I just Dick Blick or Blick, you know, pre-cut sizes. I usually get their bigger sizes because then I can cut them down to smaller sizes.
Yeah. I did that recently and got some actually like lovely soft linoleum. I was really surprised with like how it's like super fresh
bat,
pliable, yeah. You know, and it freaks me out and I want to like encase it in like plastic so it doesn't get any, like, so it doesn't dry at all.
Anything hard. Yeah. But yeah, you know, I think so. Yeah. So that was one thing that, you know, in the beginning I figured out, for me. And then I think I was telling you about I coat the block with gesso, like a very thin layer of gesso.
Yeah.
And the reason I do that, a couple of reasons, when I'm doing my drawing, I can start out with a pencil drawing, because what I do is I start with a pencil drawing and then I move to with a marker, and then I go over to ink and brush. And so, sometimes before what I would do is just draw with a pencil and then I would carve it.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I couldn't see the drawing as well because the gray. And, if I coat it with a thin layer of gesso, I can see the drawing much easier and then I can start working with it. So, because also if you're going to use brush and ink, the gesso really helps to absorb, it sticks to the gesso better than just the plain linoleum.
And you don't want like bleed happening either, right? Like,
yeah. So it's really nice. I mean, you don't get any scatter or anything like that. So the gesso provides a little bit, but it is a ground that you can, but the key is that you don't put it on real thick. You just really thin with a sponge brush, because actually if you use a regular, like a bristle brush, You'll pick up, if you can actually print some of the bristles, because it's, you know, if you're printing, you might be really fine in your printing, you can pick up some of that. So basically I would just use like a sponge brush, with the gesso and just coat the whole block. And the other thing is like, and I know a lot of people will stain their blocks, but this way you can, gesso it and then you draw on it. And then you're going to have that change of the gray of the gesso and the white. So you get, so when you're carving, you can see where you've been. Mm-hmm. I know like Huck, well, he stains it with red marker. After he's drawn it, he'll stain over it.
Yeah.
Which works great. And I actually have done that with, you can use screen printing ink and stain your block. Anyway, oh, yeah. The gesso does, you know, allows me to do that too. I can see where I've been. So yeah, that was something. To be honest with you, I don't know if anybody else does that, but I'm pretty much the only one that does. But it works great if you're gonna use India ink when you draw on the block. And that kind of became a big part of my work, was like the brush strokes. Because a lot of people would look at my prints from a distance and say, "Oh, you're doing these ink and brush drawings." And I said, "No, they're prints," because I was replicating the brush mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it really comes through. Like once I heard that in that other interview on Huck's Outlaw podcast, Outlaw Printmakers, I think it's called. And it, once I looked at your prints and I looked at like the way the marks flowed, it explained a lot visually what I was already seeing, but not, you know, I don't know. I like nerding out and like knowing how things are made, you know. I think that's, we artists kind of come at things like that. But
I got really into that too, because like, what I would do is I would put the ink on the block and then I'd tilt it up and let it drip. And that, so for a while there, I was doing these drippy, and that's where you got the snot thing. Yeah. Well, I had the big globs. So, but it was the dripping of the ink, and then I would just let that dry and I would carve it. So it was letting the ink do its thing and I would carve it out. So, it became a lot about texture. And that's another thing about my work in terms of the imagery. It's, I just love a lot of texture, and it's like, you got to have these crazy weird things and to put a lot of texture, like big pustules and bumps and things oozing. You know, I think a lot of it came because I wanted to create a lot of texture, and it sort of made sense to be doing these kind of images to allow that to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to reinvent mark making in relief printing because it's mm-hmm, all, it's mm-hmm. all positive or negative only. And like, you can see, you know, some people go very like on and off, and it's like there's like no texture. It's like super clean. There's like a whole movement of that on Instagram right now with like flowers and birds and stuff. And and then there's like an approach where I feel like you're drawing with a chisel, but it's like you can still kind of peel that apart, like where you can tell a U gouge versus a V gouge and things. But it's when you draw with an interesting drawing tool and then carve that as faithfully as you can, you capture like this other language that you're kind of, you know, shoehorning into the, to the relief style, which I think is just nice. It kind of stands out differently. And, like I've been getting into like, do you ever get in super detailed and go in with like a knife and like cut out a whole design, like really intricately, like a Japanese woodcut or something?
Oh, well, I mean, I usually use, cause I only use two gouges. I use the number one, and they're the Speedball disposable blades.
So
The number one and the number five. So the one is the one that makes the little tiny mark.
Yeah. That's like the outliner tool for like everything. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'll definitely geek out in those spots there where, you know, I mean, and that's what happens when I'm drawing. If I get like a piece of ink that goes to the, you know, I'll leave it. I won't deny it. You know, so it's like the randomness of the inking, is kind of, yeah, I like that. I like to leave that in there, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, there is that sort of spontaneity, but it comes to, the spontaneity comes from the drawing, as opposed, like you're saying with the carving, I'm pretty faithful to the drawing, to whatever's there. So the spontaneity really, only comes if I'm making some sort of, creating some values or something like that, where I need sort of a middle value, you know, through horizontal lines and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And I saw for paper, and so you use like your ink, right? Basically.
Yeah.
It works.
But that's interesting about the ink. I went through, it took, you know, and I think you could talk to every printmaker about ink. I mean, I started out using Daniel Smith, They're
yeah.
That stuff was great.
That Black Relief, but, that ink?
Yeah, dude. It was a really, really good ink, and I know a lot of people used it, and then...
That was my go-to, man. I have one yeah. can left. I have one unsealed can. I'm like...
Oh, man, that's gold.
Ready
right
to get into, yeah. But it's yeah. weird that that whole brand and line just kind of went away, and they
yeah.
refocused and on watercolor yeah, or something.
You know, one thing that's interesting about that is that I know a lot of people used it, and it started... Like a later work that I use when I print it, I got a lot of bronzing going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that everybody, it happened to everybody. But then I know people called them up and said, "Listen, what's going on? The ink is bronzing," and they were like, "No, we haven't changed the formula or anything." But I heard a story that they changed the linseed oil brand that they were using. It was the same, you know, they were using linseed oil.
Huh.
And you know, this might be total BS, but which kind of makes sense though. It could have been because it's the oil that causes the bronzing, right? I mean, so. So after a while, I stopped using it because of that. And then I switched over to, then I went through this period of like searching, you know, I was searching yeah. for the ink that worked. You know, I used, you know, Graphic Chemical, I never really got into Charbonnel. And then some of the more commercial inks, cause the folk like, Martin Mazur was telling me about some of the more commercial stuff that he used.
Like Hanco,
yeah, Hanshi,
yeah,
you know, and those, which actually some of those work pretty well. But then at about that time, I started working with Speedball. So then, now I don't have any worries about ink. I'm totally happy where I am. But it's interesting how there was this period of, I mean, there was a moment of time there where that my prints were just turning out crap. I just couldn't get them to print right. And I think it was the ink I was using. I wasn't happy with it. But I think everybody has their ink stories. I've never been one to modify my inks, though. I've always pretty much used them straight out of the can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah I was never, yeah. I was that way. I've always been a little, I don't know how to say. I can be kind of judgy on how people treat their ink or like, I don't know. There's some people I've seen like one guy I know, they never change the color. It's all straight out of the can. And when I look at the work, I'm just like, man, this would just like really sing if you tweaked some of these colors because you're too limited with like what's just available. I don't know. When you're doing color work, you know, it's like there's a million colors.
That's the thing, yeah. I keep it easy, just sticking pretty much to black ink. So,
but yeah, it wasn't until I think I got into letterpress. Like I knew to add oil and stuff like over the years, like through Intaglio and all these different things we did. But yeah. You know, we even made ink in grad school. Well, actually, in undergrad at Iowa, we made all the black ink we used in the studio was handmade in-house. Mm-hmm. And it was like this like grueling thing we had to do as part of the end of each semester.
Rite of passage, right? You have to
make the ink. There was this like old dirty room in the back of the studio that was like full of all this like old black equipment, you know, and they would make this just amazing etching ink. Phenomenal, like better than you can buy anywhere, you know. But then I got into letterpress, like after all the schooling and everything was done, I got into letterpress afterwards. And that's where I really learned about all kinds of other stuff like viscosity and tack and like kind of fine tuning a whole bunch of things that I probably didn't have solutions for back in the day or didn't know I needed that solution. But like adding mag powder to like make it, you know, denser and thicker at times or... You know, if things are tearing or sticking, there's other tweaks you can do with oils and, you know, easy wipe or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
it's chemistry stuff, you know.
I've always marveled at the printers who know all that stuff. I mean, I've known some people who are just like, they're genius with that, you know. It's actually, I love being around people who are really good with ink because they're like, how the hell did you get that? You know, like, or color mixing, you know, I'm just like, I've met a few people who are just unbelievable color mixing.
Yeah.
And I just don't know how they do it. It's just, you know, it's something that's inside of them. You know, they're able to do that. And it's such a great skill, but I'm terrible at it. So
it's a bit of
black ink.
It's obsessive. Yeah. And that's the same thing too. Like I was only black and white for like forever. I tried color over and over and it was just clumsy. I feel like the outcomes I had
but with
black and white, I could just achieve a much more resolved thing, you know? Mm-hmm, and then, it was like screen printing, I think, and letterpress that like both of them I came to like after grad school even. And learning through those, it was like, I learned like transparency and like, you know, all that, the Pantone color mixing and all that stuff. Mm-hmm, and then you know, you get into projects where you're printing on like a blue paper, but you need to match a Pantone red color.
Oh my God, it's like
it's literally like testing it over and over and over to make some really weird mix look like a Pantone that you have a formula to make, but it's like you're trying to factor in the blue coming through and kill the transparency with opaque white without making it look chalky. And I don't know. I love that stuff.
That's rocket science, man. That's just
grueling.
Yeah, but it's so cool to watch that. I think that's the, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about printmaking. It's like, I think even if you don't do it, just you can appreciate the, you know, that part of it. I just like going into a shop where there's people who, you know, like if they're just printers, you know, that go in there and just watch them, you know, do that stuff. It's like, holy crap, that's so cool. I mean, I can't do it, but I like to watch, see this, watch what they do.
Well, let's talk about, you did this book with Beth Grabowski, and it's in like the second printing. Is that second edition?
Yeah. It's been out. The second edition came out a few years back. It was an amazing project. Working with Beth was really tremendous. I mean, she knows so much more about printmaking than I do, so that was good. But it was killer. It came out. I worked on it when my daughter was born. So my daughter's 13 now, and I remember when we first started the project, Beth was like, because Beth has kids who are, you know, older, and she knew what I was getting into. And I said, "Oh yeah, no problem. You know, I won't have any problem doing this." And she was like, "Yeah, okay."
Sure.
And then my daughter was born, and man, it was tough. I mean, actually, at the time, that's all I was doing was working on the book and taking care of my daughter, and I did teach a little bit, but it was grueling. And the grueling thing is just there was just so much work. And Beth did all the writing, and I did all the other stuff like getting it, approvals for the images, you know, all the technical sort of side stuff that we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine doing that as one person. So it worked out really well because Beth could just focus on the drawing, I mean, on the writing. And then, so she would write, she'd send it to me, I'd look at it and give her feedback. But the thing was, we got a little behind, and it really, basically the publisher was like putting us under fire. Like, you've got to get this, you know, like this is the deadline. And so it got really stressful. But then once it was done, it was great. And it's been great because it's been getting, you know, it's gotten a lot of distribution. And it is in the second, it's in the second edition. It's been in like, gosh, like 8 different languages. It's been, you know, it's really great. So
that's amazing. Yeah.
It's been cool. And, in the end, it was a great experience, but it was brutal. It was brutal. I think anybody who gets into that to be prepared for a rough ride.
I've dreamt about it. I feel like at some point I'll do a book. I don't know what it'll, if it'll be a print cast related thing or if I'll do something different. I don't know. I can feel it coming somewhere down the line, you know, but it is daunting, and I know that it would consume me completely. So it's hard to figure out like, how would I pull off such a big project like that? And do anything else, you know, but did you guys see like a void just in the books that were available at the time, or like you wanted something that, like, more up to date? Cause oftentimes like older books will just kind of not have the most contemporary processes or materials in mind.
Yeah. Well, you know, the publisher, they do a lot of research. So they were like, they had seen that there was a need for a new book.
Okay.
It was weird. Actually, the way it worked was they solicited us, and it was kind of weird because they solicited Beth and us separately without us knowing. Kind of interesting. But since we know each other, and like I wrote to her and I said, you know, I just met with this editor and they want to do this book. And they say, you know, and I don't know if the editor had mentioned something about Beth. Maybe that was it. And anyway, so we ended up like saying, well, we should team up and do this. But the publisher, they do a lot of research on, like, you know, they'll talk to a lot of people and say like, what, you know, what's missing, what needs to be done, you know, what kind of stuff needs to, do you find, or are there books that are out of date, things like that. So they had done a lot of research. So we kind of knew what they wanted and what they had heard, but, you know, obviously a lot of, we were dictating the way the book was going to go. But they, and like we had a lot, they, when we finished it, there was, they put it before a bunch of people, not a bunch, but, you know, there were some readers, people who read it, and then they had their comments, and then we responded to those.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot that goes into it behind the scenes. And I think the one thing that I definitely learned, and I was the one who was in charge of finding the images and stuff like that, is that I was trying to, you know, rely upon just my knowing people, and then just, or like someone would say, well, you should, you know, if you like this work, you can contact this person. But that got super stressful because I was having to get permissions and waiting for people to respond. And then, you know, as we were on this deadline, it was like waiting and waiting for these images. And we're like, well, you know, they're like, well, what's the deal with the images? So I would recommend anybody who gets into making a book that they actually get a image budget, and then they work with these organizations that you can get permission to use the images and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because otherwise it was pretty tough, because I was kind of calling in favors and all this kind of stuff, and it just got really stressful because I was waiting on people to send stuff back, or people were like, well, you know, what's going on, or, you know, anyway, it was that part of it. But, you know, if you go with one of these organizations that sort of these image organizations, image rights organizations, basically you just go to them and say, okay, I want to use this image. And they're the ones who you pay them, and they give you the rights to do it, and you get all the copy, you know, everything's all good. So, I don't know if you've seen Phil Sanders' new book that just came out. And like, he great images.
Knocked
in that
it
book.
Out, man. Yeah.
I think he's killer.
He said, I think, cause I talked to him about it, I think he said they freshly photographed like all of it to make sure it was just like excellent. And honestly, when you look through it, do you have a copy of it or?
Yeah, our library just got it. So
yeah, it's really nice. Bold and bright, and like it's you just get sucked in, man. Like it's almost like looking at the real work, you know.
Mm-hmm. But I want to talk to him about that, because I'm sure that was not an easy thing to reproduce all the, you know. I mean, he's got so many contacts within, you know, having those prints or working with printers and stuff like the actual print, but then just getting the permission for all that stuff is just, you know, even people that, you know, it's like, you know, maybe they go on vacation or no, you know, it's like trying to get that information from them. It can be, but anyway, the whole image, that part of it was really tough and stressful. Mm-hmm. But in the end it all paid off. But yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if I would recommend it. let's say if you did a book about that was related to your podcasting, and I mean, that might be a little different, because it's like, you know, it's like your experience is very direct and very, I mean, with a sort of comprehensive printmaking book, you got to like go out and do all of this stuff, you know? And, I think if the more focused the book, it might be a little easier, just because you can, not have to like go outside and say, okay, I don't know anything about this, but we have to write about it. And we got to find stuff for this, like, you know, and go for it. I mean, cause that book, it does cover everything. You know, just things like safety, you know, like I had to go tracking down all the safety stuff and community, you know, like things that you think you could just use. You can't just use the image because it's the property of a different organization. And so it's, I don't know. Anyway, I'm looking forward to your book. So.
Yeah, someday.
Cool, Nick. Well, thanks a lot, man. I enjoyed it. And I'm sure we'll be, looking forward to this. And seeing what you make of it. And I'm sure we'll be in touch over the, you know, whatever.
Cool.
All right, man.
All right, thanks man. Yep, take care.
Take care. Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning into the Printcast and my interview with Bill Fick. Thanks, of course, to Bill for coming on the show and sharing about his life and his work. Be sure to look him up on Instagram under LinoBill. He's a linocut artist, and we shared some really cool stuff of his process today. I hope you got something out of that if you're into relief printmaking. As always, you can find back episodes about the show at theprintcast.com. We're on every podcast platform, I think, that is out there, so you can listen to me wherever you want. And you can always support the show on Patreon for as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/theprintcast. Thanks for listening to the show today. I appreciate all of you so much. And one more time with my favorite ending to the show.
This is the Printcast, the best podcast about printmaking ever made.
You've been listening to the Printcast. a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you are listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find the Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of the Printcast. Bye for now.